Hi, I'm David Kleon, senior editor at Blogging Heads TV, and this is another episode of Worldwise, and I'm speaking once again with Elena Tregub. Elena, you can introduce yourself briefly.
Yeah, I'm Elena Tregub. I run an educational consulting here in Washington, D.C., which is related to Central Eastern Europe. I'm sending students for professional internships. One of the programs is professional internship in the Ukrainian parliament. And I'm also a political analyst, and I used to work as a journalist for many years before.
Yes. And this is our third conversation. Our last one was less than a week ago. So I should just say before we begin, we are recording at around 2:30 p.m., Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday. And I mention this because our last conversation went up, you know, maybe 12 hours after we recorded it. And in the time between when we had that conversation and when it posted, the situation in Ukraine went from, you know, the apparent triumph of protesters on the Independence Square in Kiev, the Maidan, which is what we mostly talked about and sort of what the new government would look like. It went from that very abruptly to a huge international geopolitical crisis over the Crimean Peninsula, which is a part of Ukraine. I'm just going to briefly establish what's been going on as of a few minutes ago, and then we can launch into some in-depth discussion of that. But, you know, the gist is that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, you know, after his client, the corrupt president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, was ousted from power, really just a week ago, and fled into exile in Russia, Putin seems to have provoked, I want to call it an invasion and an occupation. It's not quite time to call it a war yet, although it could be by the time we finish talking. Shots have not been fired. Unlike in Independence Square, where Yanukovych killed a large number of people very recently, of protesters, so far there has been no actual violence between Russia and Ukraine. There are Russian troops on the ground in Crimea, and it's, of course, worth pointing out that there's a huge Russian naval base in the Crimean city of Sevastopol, which is there by agreement between the Russian and Ukrainian governments, which has a lease for, I think, into the 2040s or something. And under international law, that's fine for there to be a naval presence right there. But that's not what's going on right now. What's going on right now is that Russian troops are actually on the ground in Crimea. They appear to be collaborating with a local prime minister of Crimea. We'll talk a little bit about what that actually means. The Russian Duma unanimously passed an order saying Russia has the right, in theory, to defend Russian speakers anywhere in Ukraine, which could include a large area of eastern Ukraine, not just Crimea itself. They have not yet done this, but they've been practicing military exercises near the border with Ukraine, and fighting could break out at any time. Secretary of State John Kerry is on the ground in Kiev right now, I believe, meeting with the victorious protesters in the Maidan. Barack Obama and other Western leaders are talking about ratcheting up economic pressure on Putin and declaring him in violation of international law. We have a lot to talk about, and of course, this is a very fast-moving situation. So, I guess we should begin with your take on just what's happened. Did you, you know, we spoke a week ago, and we talked a little about Crimea. We talked a little about, you know, will Ukraine hold together? But did you foresee that Putin would do anything this brazen and so quickly?
Well, obviously, it was expected that Putin would do something because Putin's agenda in Ukraine failed. It is very clear what Putin wants to do. Putin wants to control Ukraine. And after people's European revolution won in Ukraine, and people are actively in control of the government, this is absolutely not what Putin wants. Putin doesn't want any democracy on his border. He wants another dictatorship so that he can, you know, form his Eurasian Union. It's the idea of Putin. This is his legacy. This is what he wants to do as a president, to be remembered in Russian history books. So it was a big, this revolution that we had in Ukraine was a big blow to him. And that he would go and occupy Crimea, invade Crimea. No, I didn't foresee that. I thought that he would arrange different provocations inside Ukraine that would disrupt the functioning of the transitional government, that would disrupt the order in Ukraine, and he would try to create chaos in Ukraine, and he would try to discredit the government, mm-hmm. discredit the revolution, and try to bring his people in power, you know, to power in Ukraine. That's what I thought. But he went, you know, he chose a much more dangerous scenario. And of course, I think Ukrainians were shocked, especially after the upper chamber of Russian government, of Russian parliament voted anonymously to start military action on the territory of Ukraine, not Crimea. But Ukraine,
right? Which they haven't done yet, but they declare they have the right to do it. And they could do at any time. Do you? Well, it's silly to make predictions, but do you think they will, or do you think they'll resign themselves to Crimea?
What I think, well, currently as we speak right now with you, there is a more or less a pause in those. Actions because there are negotiations going on. There is a lot of pressure, especially from the United States, which is being put on Putin. So, as you know, for one day, the Russian market lost $60 billion,
yes.
$10 billion more than Putin spent on the Olympics.
Yeah, I think they recovered about half of it today. But yeah, it was a huge, unexpected blow. But yeah, they've lost a lot.
So I think right now what's happening, how I take it, Putin, I think he became the victim of his own propaganda because he doesn't have adequate information on Ukraine. He thought, obviously, that it would be very easy for him to take over Crimea and eastern Ukraine because he thought that there is support for him, for Russia, and that the Ukrainian troops would voluntarily...
So just to play Putin's advocate for a second, I don't want to advocate mm-hmm. what he's doing because I think it's a gross violation of international law, and I don't think there's much debate about that. I mean, Russia has signed border treaties with Ukraine, which it's clearly violating now. This is a very dangerous situation that I think Putin has pretty much single-handedly created. But that said, just in terms of evaluating his strategy, it actually has been pretty easy for him to take over Crimea, right? I mean, he effectively does control Crimea right now. Eastern Ukraine might be harder if he tries for that, but Crimea, it seems like he took it without a shot fired and pretty much controls it.
Yeah, but when you say controls it, it doesn't mean that Ukrainian military isn't there. Because this was, Ukrainian strategy was not to start violence. So what happened over and over again that Russian military would approach Ukrainian military and tell them surrender, give up their weapons. But, Ukrainian military would say get lost. And that's basically what was happening. But Russian military wouldn't dare, you know, start shooting them, although they said numerously that they would do it, but they don't do that. Because what Putin wanted, he wanted Ukrainians to start violence.
Right.
And then, because it's a similar technology he used in Georgia.
Yes, a little background
it didn't
here.
Work.
Right. I should mention this, actually, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about this to this day in the U.S., in 2008, of course, around the time of another Olympics in Beijing, Putin invaded Georgia. and the world was briefly riveted by that. Now, there's a fair amount of evidence that Saakashvili, the president of Georgia at the time, who was a U.S. client, actually did fire the first shots. He fired them on Russian peacekeepers who had been in the Georgian breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia indefinitely. So in that case, Putin was able to say that Georgia started the fight. I mean, not that he didn't want the fight, Putin, but he was able to say that, and it got him a little bit of leeway. So far, no one is fired, but it's Putin invading Ukraine basically unprovoked. I mean, he would claim provocation, but very few people elsewhere see it that way. But it's true, if Ukrainians fire on Russian troops first, that would play right into Putin's hands, right?
Absolutely, and there are fears right now that this standoff continues in Crimea. So there are some reports on social media coming up that there are Russians who are dressed as Ukrainian troops, and they want to kill their own Russian soldiers in order to start the, you know, violence, or that there are there will be terrorist attacks, there will be explosions, there will be other types of provocations. I think this is what Ukrainians are afraid about, because Ukrainian strategy of not going directly against Putin militarily plays very well right now, because negotiations are going on, the pressure is on, and Putin is losing this information and psychological war that he started, because the whole world sees that he is occupying another country without any reason, just because, you know, he decided to do so, because he's a big, powerful nation.
As best as I can tell, the way that Putin sees the situation in Ukraine is as follows. He thinks that the protesters staged a coup. Basically, he sees Yanukovych as a democratically elected leader under Ukraine's constitution, which is apparently very important to Putin. And he was, you know, overthrown in a coup. And now the rights of Russians and Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine and in Crimea are threatened potentially by the new Ukrainian government. Now, this is, you know, I know you're going to say this is a trumped up justification, and I agree. That said, let's talk a little about the Russian language speakers in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. Let's say Putin hadn't done this. Let's say, you know, going back a week and expanding on what we were talking about earlier, what was their situation looking like before Putin mm-hmm. decided to invade? How are they going to be represented in the new Ukraine after Yanukovych was overthrown? Yanukovych, who they had voted for.
Well, actually, Russian speakers, both in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine, they have all the rights, you know, to speak Russian language. Nobody is, you know, discriminating them based on that. And the pretext that Putin is mentioning is that the parliament voted to repeal the language law, which was adopted during Yanukovych times. And this law was supposed, like, to give Russian language as a, like, almost the status of the second language in Ukraine, second official language. But this law really didn't even work properly. And this law was more like a symbolic gesture on the part of Yanukovych. Mm-hmm. And then the parliament voted to repeal this law, but this law is still acting right now, because the acting president Turchinov didn't sign this law. So nothing, absolutely nothing changed.
So Turchinov, I have not followed him much. He hasn't been one of the big names we've heard in association with the opposition movement. But he's the acting president, and I have to say I should be objective about this, but I tend to think that Parliament voting to repeal the law, you know, symbolic though the law may have been, was kind of a symbolic move in its own right and not a very good one. I mean,
it wasn't very smart.
No, I mean, first of all, it gave Putin this pretext, not that he needed. I mean, I'm sure he would have come up with something. But it also, I mean, the reality is if Ukraine's going to hold together, it's going to need to accommodate everyone in the country, right? And there are, there's a huge percentage of the population that speaks, a minority that speaks really only Russian. And there's also a very large percentage of the population that speaks both languages and sort of, freely mixes them. I mean, it's very diverse from region to region and city to city. But it seems like the only way Ukraine's going to possibly hold together is if they come to some kind of accommodation to all this diversity. I mean, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. That's the only way to do this. But I think new Ukrainian authorities, they already, understood that they need to have a coalition in the parliament, and all the people who represent east of Ukraine, Yanukovych's party of the region, even though many of them are guilty, of protesters being killed because they had tools which would allow them to stop the violence, but they did not. But they are not being prosecuted right now. They are still in the parliament, and they are working because Ukrainians majorly agree that we need to keep our country together. And so there should be this consensus found between those who are in the East and even those who were against Maidan. They are now working with the government because they acknowledge it is legitimate. And a lot of people from his party, they spoke that Yanukovych betrayed the party by escaping Ukraine, by shooting protesters. And even the former speaker of the parliament, Yanukovych ally, said that when Yanukovych was saying that there was an attempt on his life, attempt on the speaker of the parliament life, his own close ally said that it's not true. Yeah. So they are now representing eastern and southern Ukraine in the parliament.
Do you have any sense? What do people in Crimea and for that matter, Donetsk and Luhansk, the main eastern regions that are mainly Russian speaking? Do you have any sense of what they actually want? Do they want more autonomy within Ukraine? Do they want to be annexed to Russia? Do they want independence? What would be the optimal outcome from their point of view, especially in Crimea? Let's start with Crimea.
Yeah, I was looking at the polls that were done recently, and around Ukraine, there are 12% of people who would like to join Russia. Mm-hmm. But this question was not asked, would you like Russia to invade us and occupy us? I wonder, somebody should have now a poll conducted asking people, are you in favor of Russian occupation? And you would have 0.1% probably of the radical pro-Russian, pro-Putin elements within Ukraine. And that's it. So people in the east of Ukraine, absolutely, they don't want to join Russia, the majority of people. And there were big protests in Kharkiv, for example, against the invasion.
Yeah, and Kharkiv is the second largest city in Ukraine, and it's in the east and has some ties to Russia, I suppose. It's kind of
It's a Russian-speaking city, although it used to be the first capital of Ukraine.
Right.
In Kharkiv, actually, 100 people suffered physically during those protests because when people came for a peaceful protest, there were provocations from pro-Putin teams of hired so-called, tetushki. Also, there were some radicals on the ground, and also there were a lot of buses coming from Russia with the Russian citizens. And the person who installed Russian flag on the roof of the city council is a Russian citizen from Moscow. And so those pro-Russian so-called activists, they attacked the peaceful protesters against Putin, and they used violence against them. There were terrible pictures of people with bleeding faces. Very famous Ukrainian writer Andriy Zhadan, Sergei Zhadan from Kharkiv, he was badly beaten in those protests. So that's what's going on. People definitely, you know, they don't want Putin's occupation. And I think Putin already saw this. And this is why he's right now on pause, because he thought that there would be bigger support for his invasion.
Right.
And it's not there. It's not there.
Right. No, I mean, the fastest way to rally a country nationally is probably to invade it. But I mean, in some ways, you could argue that Putin has inadvertently done the new government in Ukraine a favor. It's made Western countries rally to their defense. It's made probably a lot of people rally to their defense.
Absolutely.
And in general has made Russia look bad. Putin seems to have overplayed his hand. That said, there have been a number of articles circulating, mostly from people who I think are, you know, Westerners who are just tuning into this conflict, suggesting, why don't we just partition Ukraine? But there was, and I think there are a lot of good reasons why we shouldn't, but there was an interesting one by a Ukrainian writer named Alexander Motel, who, he didn't so much say that we should partition Ukraine. He acknowledged there'd be a lot of problems with it, but he made the case that Ukraine would actually be better off if Donetsk and Lugansk and Crimea left and became just, you know, Russian protectorates or whatever, you know, like Abkhazia. That if they weren't a part of Ukraine, Ukraine would actually be both more politically unified around independence, because it would lose these areas that, you know, are Russian leaning, and also that although traditionally the eastern areas are thought of as the more economically developed areas of the country, he actually argued that it's more of a rust belt, and I think his phrase was that they shake down Kiev for money, and he thought the country would actually be more open to economic development and modernization if it didn't have to take mm-hmm. care of these regions. So what do you think? Should Ukraine let the East and the South go, or does Ukraine need to be united in its current borders?
I agree with Professor Motel's argument that Ukraine, like the Western Central Ukraine, would be better off without those mm-hmm. regions, because definitely it's very united. It will be more like Poland, because there wouldn't be those controversial things going on.
Right. It would be a more homogenous country.
It will, yeah. But the thing is, with those eastern regions, I think Ukrainians, like in Kiev especially, the central government, they want to keep the eastern part for the sake of the people in the east. And yes, Western Central would be better off, but what would happen to those who would become Russian protectors? They wouldn't be better off. And there are a lot of Ukrainians who are with Ukraine, who are sharing the same, you know, European democratic values that Maidan stands for, from those regions. And there are a lot of heroes in this group that we call the Holy 100, those people who died on Maidan,
yes.
Who were coming from eastern Ukraine, who were fighting for Ukraine. And they live there. This is where they're coming from. And so just to abandon them and tell, I'm sorry, like, we're sorry, but you have, like, not very good groups in society that don't support democracy, who are not sure what they stand for, and we need to abandon you, and you will become like Transnistria or Abkhazia.
Right.
It's just not fair. And right now, the effort of the central government is to pull through together as a country and help those in the east join the rebuilding, like a prosperous democratic Ukraine. And Putin's invasion, actually, of Crimea helped to unify the nation. Right now, even those who were in favor of, so-called customs union, Russia, Putin, they reconsider. When they saw, the true face of Putin, who can just come and invade without any pretext, they showed more support to the government in Kiev.
Yeah.
So it's a good development, I think, for the unity.
Yeah, I get that impression as well. Now, so God willing, this will still be true by the time we post this and hopefully indefinitely. But so far, real violence has been avoided. And it's occurred to me that this is mostly, I think, strategic. Neither side wants to be seen as the one starting the war. But one thing I haven't seen raised anywhere, and I'm just wondering from my, I've spent time in both countries, especially Russia, from my personal experience with Russians and Ukrainians, I'm wondering if, I mean, Putin sees them as Slavic brothers. They do have a lot of history in common, and not just the ethnic Russians in the eastern part of the country, but even in central Ukraine, there's centuries of shared history with Russia under the empire, under the Soviet Union. There's a lot of cultural overlap. And I am wondering, does anyone in Russia or Ukraine really want a shooting war? In general, I'm sure people don't want war with anyone, but it seems sort of hard to imagine that this would be popular even in Russia, even if they oppose the overthrow of Yanukovych, even if they have problems with the protesters on the Maidan. I mean, people have relatives in both countries. People travel and go to the beach from Russia to Ukraine, and people in Ukraine go to work in Russia. I cannot imagine that there's popular legitimacy in either country for a real war between them. I mean, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think for Russians, we don't see big protests against the war. We saw protests, rallies against the war in Moscow, for example, but they are not huge just because Russians, they are not used to protesting and they agree with whatever Putin decides. But when it comes to real war, when they face those real circumstances when they have to kill, Ukrainians, I think there will be much bigger opposition against the war in Russia than we currently have.
I mean, I think of it as if there were a war between the U.S. and Canada or something. These are two very culturally close and economically connected countries. It would be, we joke about war with Canada, but it's not something we could ever imagine doing,
Absolutely, yeah. And but on the Ukrainian side, there are reports of men enlisting themselves in the Ukrainian army to defend Ukraine. So they are Ukrainian population. They have this psychological advantage that they are ready to fight because they want to defend Ukraine. So I think they are quite mobilized. But regarding this question, I wanted to tell you a fresh story, I think, from yesterday, when Russian military, Russian Navy, when they tried to overtake the Russian, Ukrainian ship, they said, surrender because we will start the storm. The captain of this Ukrainian ship, he said, Russians don't surrender.
Huh.
And the Russian commander said, excuse me, I don't understand. And he says, I am Russian, but I gave an oath to Ukrainian state and I don't surrender.
Wow.
That's what he responded.
Huh.
So the confrontation didn't happen. Russian Navy just left. This is what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem... I mean, if I had to guess right now, and someone can play this back for me when I turn out to be completely wrong, I almost feel like both sides are kind of planning on extending today's situation. I mean, if the status quo going forward is Putin is occupying Sevastopol... he's occupying Crimea. Of course, he occupies Sevastopol. He's occupying Crimea, and he's talking a lot about how he could invade Ukraine if he wanted to. And Ukraine, its new government, is talking a lot about how we'd like to expel Putin from Crimea. But in point of fact, neither side actually does anything. And they both just sit still. I mean, that's not a great outcome, but I could sort of imagine both sides deciding that's the least worst outcome for both of them, you know, and both of them trying to spin it as they've won the situation. You know, Ukraine's won the support of the West and Putin's international isolation. Putin has shown that he can, you know, flagrantly violate Ukraine's territory and take over Crimea, which is very important to him. Nobody gets killed. I mean, maybe that's where all this is going, or do you think things could get worse?
Well, I'm not sure that this is the end, because yes, Putin now effectively controls Crimea militarily. He has more of his troops in Crimea than Ukrainians do. So if he wants, he can technically, you know, overtake Crimea. But there is still a standoff. How is he going to, you know, to keep Crimea? How is he going to maintain, you know, people in Crimea? There are a lot of groups who oppose, like Crimean Tatars.
Right.
They are afraid that Putin will start genocide on them like Stalin did.
Yeah.
Because they are very pro-Ukrainian. And they already, there are reports that Russian, like hired thugs who are in Crimea, they are putting some marks on the buildings where Crimean Tatar lives.
Oh, wow.
Because they want them to kind of purge Crimea from Crimean Tatars, which is really scary. And moreover, when you mentioned the new leader of Crimea, this person belongs to organized crime. He's a criminal.
Yeah, and what is his name? I don't know
myself. Aksyonov.
Aksyonov is the newly installed prime minister of Crimea.
Yeah, nobody.
We should note, by the way, that Crimea had a certain degree of autonomy within Ukraine and has its own parliament. It's a unique region within the country, right? So.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I think for Crimeans, they would agree if. Like Crimea remains an autonomous territory, and but this is not what Russia wants. Russia wants it to be Russian territory. And when they occupied Crimea, they didn't set the Crimean flags everywhere. They set Russian flags on buildings.
Right.
So this is not what those who in Crimea want. So how is Putin going to maintain Crimea under his control? I don't have an answer to that.
I don't know. I think everyone is wondering whether Putin understands rationally that he may have overstepped in invading, or whether he has lost touch with reality, as a lot of people, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel, have suggested. So speaking of her, let's talk a little about the Western response. And actually, before we get to Merkel, let's talk about the American response. How do you think Barack Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry have handled the situation so far?
Well, so far they are putting pressure on Putin diplomatically, economically, politically. Well, so far we see no violence. We don't see Putin advancing to eastern, central Ukraine. So I think it might be working, because, you know, Putin is the leader of Russia, but he has his, oligarchs, different economic groups who support his regime. And if the cost on Russia is too high, they will abandon him. For example, White House is now claiming that they are developing a package of severe economic sanctions on Russia. So Russians are waiting to see what those sanctions are, how serious they are.
Right. The White House's line, which I think is an interesting one, is that Putin is fighting a 19th century kind of classic imperial war of aggression. And that Putin doesn't understand that 21st century Russia, post-Soviet Russia, is in fact part of the global economy. I think that's what our recently departed U.S. Ambassador Michael McFaul says. and is therefore very vulnerable to this kind of thing. I mean, the Russian elite, who are extraordinarily wealthy by any standard, you know, they travel to Western countries to go on vacation. They keep their assets in Western banks. They send their children to school and own property in Western countries. There are many, many ways that their lives could be difficult. And I guess the theory is that's the only place Putin could feel pressure from is Russian elites, because Russian society has no real vehicle for expressing its discontent. But
Yeah, absolutely. So those Russian elites, unlike Ukrainian elites, they have their assets in the United States, not only in Europe. The main country, of course, is the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And United Kingdom is benefiting economically a lot from Russian elites being present there, investing in the UK. And now when we observe, there are two countries who co-signed Budapest Memorandum together with Russia. It's the UK and the United States. And they promised that in exchange for Ukraine voluntarily giving up the third largest nuclear arsenal, they would guarantee its territorial integrity.
Right. This is something that happened at the after the end of the Cold War. The
1994. And so we see that America is much more active right now on, you know, on this memorandum than the United Kingdom, because the United Kingdom is linked with Russia economically, I think, way too much.
Well, and so they're linked with Russia mostly through this investment from Russian oligarchs. Germany, yeah. Which I mentioned earlier, has become extremely intertwined with Russia in terms of energy and being sort of a major importer of Russian energy. So is Merkel capable? I mean, she's said some tough things recently, but is she capable of standing up to Putin in a way that actually matters, do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think yes. I think Europe, it's time for Europe to actually reconsider their energy independence, because European energy security was a vulnerable spot for very, like, many years recently, because they depend on Russian hydrocarbons way too much, mm-hmm. and they need to diversify. And I think they were already moving in that direction, exploring shale gas opportunities, exploring other importers and alternative pipelines. And now I think Merkel understood they need to move even faster.
Yeah.
Because.
But maybe not fast enough to. I mean, if I worry that, although on the one hand I think Putin needs to face. You know, real consequences for what he's done, and those obviously can't be military. I mean, the U.S. can't start a war with Russia. That's a non-starter. But for all kinds of reasons. But on the other hand, I do worry that, although I think we could do serious, we the West, U.S., Europe could do serious economic damage to Russia. I worry how much damage they could do in turn in the process. I mean, if they cut off energy, it could devastate European economies and it could cause a global economic crisis. I mean, mm-hmm. I think everyone, including Putin, has some stake in avoiding this. But that does limit what we can actually do in some ways. Obviously, we can do symbolic things like, you know, kick him out of the G8. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure any of the countries involved, especially in Western Europe, can really afford an all-out economic war with Russia. I mean, what do you think?
I think they wouldn't have to go to the full-blown, like, Cold War, economic war, when all the ties are blocked. Because it just doesn't make sense to me. It's just like we are returning to the 20th century. And when you said Russians can cut supplies, you imagine if Putin starts invasion, active invasion on Ukrainian territory, and Ukrainians, for example, let's imagine that Europe is passive, America is passive, they only do things diplomatically, they don't help Ukrainians, and Ukrainians are left with a huge Russian army on their own. Ukrainians can cut, you know, the pipes their own, on their sure. own.
It's true. Ukraine is not a major producer, but it is the major corridor for Russian energy. Oh,
absolutely. Europe. And it will disrupt, it will be a huge blow to Europe. So Europe cannot stay, not engaged. Well, it's basically, there are so many potential scenarios this may go, which may cause like the Third World War. This is why, right now we see people on both sides of Atlantic so worried about what Putin did, because it just doesn't make sense.
Now, do you, speaking of the new Cold War and getting back to Obama a little bit, I almost hate to bring this up because I hate this topic so much, but I feel I should. Do you feel that Obama's conservative critics who have accused him of naivete vis-a-vis Putin and Russia and of not taking a strong stand early enough in this conflict, do you feel that Obama could have and should have done more earlier before Putin invaded Crimea, or do you think or do you think that he's made the right calls?
No, absolutely. On Ukraine, Obama started to act really, really late. Maidan, people of Ukraine, they were addressing Obama for several months, asking his administration to implement targeted sanctions against human rights violators in Ukraine, those who are beating protesters, those who are killing protesters, because the hope was that if you introduce sanctions against some pillars of Yanukovych regime, some people from his team, not all people, not the top leadership, if you just fragment the team of Yanukovych, segment them into those who are being targeted and those who are not yet being under sanctions, then you create this tension within his team and you help this regime crumble faster. Well, and so Obama didn't do that. They introduced sanctions only after everything was practically over.
Well, so let me push back against that a little bit, actually. I see the situation slightly different. I think that's correct in terms of what people asked for and what Obama didn't do. But in terms of what the White House might have been thinking, I mean, as things have worked out, Yanukovych was overthrown and with a very light footprint from Washington. It doesn't look like Washington made this happen. I know Putin is arguing that Washington made this happen, but I don't think that's seen as very credible generally. I mean, Ukrainians really did overthrow Yanukovych themselves. And let's say Obama had gone after Putin earlier at any point, not just in this crisis, but at any point in the last few years, the way that he's proposing to do now, he would have started a crisis like this a lot earlier. I mean, the optics right now are such that Putin looks like the aggressor. Putin looks like the one who started this. I always wonder this whenever I see John McCain or whoever, saying we should take a more aggressive, or Mitt Romney, that we should take a more aggressive stance toward Russia. Why should we be the ones to force this crisis? Why can't we let it come to us as we've done?
I mean, well, you know why? Because, yes, Ukrainians did it themselves without any support, but at what cost? You know, more than 1,000 people injured. Some of them, they keep dying. Like every day almost, we have reports of a new person dead after they were gunned down on Maidan. And 100 people shot. And I think if Obama introduced targeted sanctions against some of the Ukrainian officials, Ukrainians were asking him to do this because America has a huge, financial influence in the world. Some visa bans would help. And Ukrainians were asking him to act as a global police defender of you know, free people, defender right. of human rights.
Well, and as you know, when the U.S. has done this, we've gotten our share of criticism for it. In fact, just to take a timely example, when John Kerry says that Putin is, you know, violating a country's sovereignty and violating mm-hmm. international law, you know, Putin points back in response, well, you know, you yourself as a United States senator voted for intervention in Iraq.
Those are different things.
Well, they're
intervention in Iraq and targeted sanctions, which could be low profile, low key. He shouldn't announce that he introduced. He should have just introduced quietly.
Okay, that makes a certain.
Why he was afraid of Putin reactions to introduce targeted sanctions quietly against some of the corrupt Ukrainians, mm-hmm. Ukrainian officials. He didn't do that.
No, you may well be right. I actually had not heard that specific proposal, and it's an interesting thing to consider. And well, in any case, it does seem as though going forward, the U.S. is very engaged on this.
Right now, yes.
We should probably wrap up, but let me know if there's any more any last points you want to make before we do about how this might play out or anything else.
Well, nobody knows right now how this may play out, but I think it has been so far. It's like, despite the fact Putin started this war as if he is in the 20th or 19th century, the war which is going on right now, it's absolutely the war of the 21st century. It's an information and psychological war. And what I see is going on in Ukraine. People are extremely stressed. The tension is incredibly high. They are very, you know, many are very scared because it's not that every day a major global nuclear power announces that they go on war
right.
with you. So, but they are kind of going, like they are overcoming this psychological stress, this demoralization, and I think Ukrainians, they are now in much better positions than they were like several days ago. They think that they will be able to preserve their country, preserve their freedom, and they hope that they will be able to do this without the bloodshed, that this crisis will be resolved.
Well, I hope that too, and I am riveted by this. I'm following it. I'm barely sleeping, so... Elena, thank you so much for this conversation and for the previous ones as well. I think I and the audience get a huge amount of insight from your perspective, and we will be following this going forward. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.